You're listening to the podcast, So You Want to Be a Writer, with Valerie Koo and Allison Tate. Valerie is an author, journalist, and national director of the Australian Writers' Centre, which is one of the world's leading providers of online and classroom courses for people who want to get published and write with confidence.
Allison Tate is a freelance writer, blogger, and author of the best-selling series, The Mapmaker Chronicles. She has more than 20 years professional writing experience.
Each week they explore the world of writing, publishing and blogging to bring you news and opportunities, advice on how to succeed in the world of writing, interviews with top writers and much more. With students enrolling from all over the world, you can find out more about the Australian Writers' Centre at writerscentre.com.au.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 207 of So You Want to Be a Writer. My name's Valerie Koo and I'm here with Allison Tate. How are you, Al?
I am fair to middling.
Fair to middling? Why?
Well, just, you know, there's no highs, there's no lows, so I'm just fair to middling. I think that's fair to middling can be pretty much what we should all be aiming for on a regular basis, don't you?
No, I reckon we should be aiming to suck the juice out of life and you know, be on highs as much as possible.
Suck the marrow.
Exactly.
Well, you know, we can aim for that, but I honestly feel that so much of the discontent in the world is because people aren't happy with fair to middling. I honestly feel like I think if you're aiming to suck the marrow every single day, you're going to be disappointed. Whereas I think if you can be happy with a little bit of contentment with just that everything's going all right stuff, I feel like as a general rule, your well-being is going to be probably a little bit better, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I never really thought about it that way. Or maybe it's it depends, I guess, on what your definition is of suck the marrow out of life, because if the little things give you that kind of, you know, thrill, then you can suck the marrow out of life constantly.
Well, true, but I don't think that everything needs to give you a thrill. I just don't think that I don't think you need a thrill out of every single thing that you do. I think the happiest people I know are the people who are content with what they're doing and what they have and where they're at. And it's that sort of constant reaching that sows seeds of discontent with a lot of people. I think that if you can look at where you're at, you know, and be aware that everything's not going to be a high all the time, then you do manage to actually skip a lot of the lows. I'm not saying don't reach on any level. I'm just saying that, you know, it's a matter of looking at, you know, assessing on a daily basis. And I'm just saying I'm fair to middling today and I'm all right with that. I've had a walk with Procrastipup. I've had a good coffee.
Aww.
I've caught up on some stuff. I've got so many emails. It's ridiculous. I've managed to clear a few. But not as many as you would like me to have cleared, I'm sure. Don't ask me about the inbox count, Val, because it won't be pretty.
I'm pretty good. Play the email game. You know the email game?
I do know the email game. I do.
Yeah.
That's where you have to, like, get as many done as you can in, you know, 30 seconds or whatever it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
How many do you get?
Not quite 30 seconds. It's maybe 5 minutes or, I don't know, a few minutes. And when you get through like 10 or 100 or whatever, then you get funny little prizes and stuff. Like, it's strangely effective.
Do you actually – is clearing your email inbox, is that a banoffee pie sort of a reward?
No.
See, I have to say that was I a person who ate banoffee pie, getting my inbox down to zero I would be able to have the entire pie, because it has never happened, ever.
Really?
No.
Oh, no. It is a much lower – it's lower than banoffee pie. It might be apricot Danish.
See, I actually –
Sara Lee.
More likely to finish an entire manuscript than I am to actually clear my inbox. So I think it would be banoffee worthy in my world.
Okay, wow.
Oh, let's not even go there, because, you know, I have a friend, Kelly Exeter, who we're actually going to talk about a little bit later on, but she actually just fully gets the heebie-jeebies discussing my inbox. She can't cope at all.
Yeah.
So we won't go there.
It's true.
Because I don't want to upset people, because I know people do get very, very upset by the notion of out-of-control inboxes.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I like to live on the edge. Maybe that's where my thrill comes from. My fair to middling thrill comes from living on the edge with my email inbox.
or anxiety.
No, see, I don't get anxious about it. That's the difference between us. No, I don't.
Wow. Okay. Well, we're very profound for, you know, this early in the morning, which is the time that we're recording this. But we just want to give a big shout out to everyone in the Facebook group. It's just such an awesome group of people talking about such interesting and diverse things. Mainly centered around writing, of course, but I love the fact that I was recently having a conversation in the Facebook group because Zelwyn kindly inquired about the painting that I did, which was based on Doris Lessing's novella, The Grandmothers. And I posted it on there and I mentioned that it was subsequently then made into a film called Adoration, starring Naomi Watts and Robin Wright. And then one of our podcast listeners, Dion, mentioned he was the makeup artist on that film. So... Yeah. And I have the biggest girl crush on Robin Wright. And I'm kind of like sort of maybe 2 degrees of separation now.
You are. You are 2 degrees of separation from someone who has touched her face.
Well,
and
Dion
that's
actually,
not creepy at all.
No. Dion didn't actually touch her face because he did other people on the set. But he did post a photo in the Facebook group of him with Xavier Samuel, who played Robin Wright's lover. So maybe I'm 4 degrees of separation from Robin Wright.
You might be getting closer. And I have a shout out as well. I'd like to give a shout out to Rhea Andriani. Hi, Rhea. And thank you so much for backing me up with the word of the week last week where you suggested, what was the word?
Bardolatry.
That's right. And I suggested it sounded like it had something to do with pubs or bars. And Rhea has come in and said that, and of course it wasn't, it was about Shakespeare. But she has given us me this small piece of information that said that Shakespeare's house did become a pub for a time. So I'm actually 2 degrees of separation closer to bardolatry being a word about bars. Okay, I'm just making that connection right there. So thank you very much for that small fact, Rhea. I'm very happy that I was able to wave that at Valerie. So appreciate it.
Oh dear. Oh, and by the way, it wasn't Zelwyn; it was Yulan. I've got the letters mixed up.
You're having a moment.
I am having a moment. But we also want to highlight something that's very, very exciting. I am super excited about it, like seriously, because we know that some people who are listeners are also copywriters and may be doing content or may have clients who are businesses. And we've got a new course launching called How to Write Media Releases. It's literally launching as this podcast comes out. And there's a special launch price, which is only available at launch if you purchase before the 31st of October. And one of the reasons I'm super excited is I think it's a great course.
But, of course.
Of course. But I sent it to a tester on the weekend and I said, okay, Clinton, I need you to test this. And he said, oh, yeah, I'll definitely test it. So not only did he complete the entire course, the course is about how to write media releases. And I literally just got an email from him. He not only completed the course, he sent out his media release this morning. He's got more to send it to, more outlets to send it to, but he sent it to a handful this morning. He's already secured an interview with Triple J and a bunch of other people who are interested in following up on the media release. And it's only early in the morning. He hasn't even finished sending out the media release to all the media outlets yet. So it works. I'm so excited.
Go now.
Yes. Anyway, that just makes me do a happy dance because he's getting results. So if you're interested in checking it out, go to writercentre.com.au/media and make sure you download a course outline because then you will be sent information about the launch discount. But let us move on to the world of writing and publishing, shall we?
Oh, probably time we did that.
Yeah. So everyone one knows, well, many people will know that Tom Hanks is a avid collector of vintage and retro typewriters. He's got quite the collection.
Well, everyone who listens to this podcast should know that because I think you've talked about it on several different occasions, being a collector of vintage typewriters yourself.
That's right. And he's even invented, or he even helped create the Hanks Writer, which is an app on your smartphones or your iPads where you know, you can type on your smartphone, on your iPad, and it simulates the experience of different typewriters. And then you can like buy different types of typewriters to simulate the different types of experiences. But anyway, Tom Hanks has just released his first book of short stories, and it's called Uncommon Type. But the reason why it's called Uncommon Type is that the link in the short stories is that there is a typewriter in each of them.
Oh, Val, it's heaven. It's Tom Hanks and typewriters combined. All you need in there is Bon Jovi and you would be just finished.
I have to say, I do not feel the same way about Tom Hanks than I do about John Bon Jovi, though.
I know that you don't. No, it was more of a, you know, link for you.
Okay. But how cool is that? So he has so the typewriter that is in the book, in each story, they all differ, and he's got a photo of an actual vintage typewriter, I'm assuming from his collection, at the start of each story. And the typewriter could play a big or small part, you know, in the story. But, of course, he wrote the whole thing on a computer, not on a typewriter.
Of course. I do like the cover, though.
Yeah,
it's nice, isn't it? I really like the cover. Yeah. Mm. Let's put a link in the show notes just so everyone can have a look at the cover, because I actually really like that.
Definitely. We'll put a link in the show notes, which, of course, you can find at soyouwanttobeawriter.com.au. So let's move on then. That's, you know, my big news of the week, because I'm definitely getting this book, buying it today.
Right. Good.
The next link that I have, which I just thought was interesting, it's on Inc.com by Amy Morin, and it's called How I Turned My Side Hustle Into a Career That Earns 10 Times the Salary of My Day Job. So she's a psychotherapist, and she had a day job, and she started to do just a little bit of writing on the side. But one of the things that she did was wrote an article called 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do, a mere 600 words, just, you know, like a blog post, really. Mm-hmm. 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. But this 600 words, as she says, changed her life, because that article went viral. Her list of 13 things was reprinted in publications like Forbes and Business Insider and Success Magazine, and more than 50 million people read it. 50 million.
50 million?
Yeah.
So, 50 million?
Yeah. Probably more by now.
Wow.
But as it sort of got shared and stuff like that, a literary agent saw it and basically contacted her and encouraged her to write a book. And within a month, she had signed a contract with one of the biggest publishers in the world.
As you do. As one does.
This little 600-word blog post just changed everything, because then she writes the actual book. It becomes an international bestseller, and it's translated into 27 languages.
Wow. Jeez, I wish I had a day like that. See, had I had a day like that, I wouldn't be answering fair to middling when you know, ask me how I am. I'd be like, I'm actually pretty good, Val.
Yes. We all want those sorts of days. But I just thought it was interesting, because it was something that obviously captured the zeitgeist at the time. It was easily shared. It was a title, because people don't share things unless their title works, right? It was a title that people responded with or were interested in, and were interested in reading about or sharing with somebody who they thought would be useful. Mm. And because of that sharing, she didn't even think of before that, she didn't think I'm going to write a book, or I even want to write a book. But it was because an agent, contacted her and suggested it that the seed was planted, and the rest is history, because that it's now shaped the rest of her career. Because pretty cool story, I reckon.
Well, it's an interesting segue, Dean. Yes. The segue is for you, okay, Dean, if you're listening. Because Dean does like to listen to our segues and give us marks out of 10. So, it's an interesting segue into our other link that we have today, which is all about funding a creative life. Because, of course, the reality is that the one 600-word blog post that is viewed by 50 million people and results in an agent and results in an international publishing deal is not how it happens for most people. I think it's really quite important that we point that out, Val, because that is the dream. That is the kind of day that you could have where you would answer, I'm pretty good, Val. Most of us are having fair to middling days, which is fine. Fair to middling days are good, as we discussed. I do like a fair to middling day. So there is a terrific post on Kelly Exeter's blog, kellyexeter.com.au. It's called How I Fund My Creative Life. And it was partly inspired by, you might remember a few weeks ago, we spoke to Tori DeRoach, who talked about how – so there were two parts of that conversation, because Tori, of course, had very much the – not quite the 50 million readers of one blog post experience, but she had this situation where she self-published her book. It was sort of like she was approached by an agent on Twitter who saw it, and out of that resulted an international publishing deal and a movie – option, et cetera, if you might remember. And then, of course, we went further with that and we discussed with Tori what happened after that. And she was talking about how she was renting out a spare room on Airbnb to help fund her creative life. So Kelly Exeter, who is she's a terrific writer herself, and she talks a lot about productivity, and she talks a lot about sort of maintaining balance in life, and she's very much your A-type overachieving sort of personality type who's had to, for various numbers of reasons, find a balance, because when you are like that, you can, go very, very hard in certain areas, and other areas of your life then become a little bit fallow. But she's someone who works through her journey and her progress in that area really well, and she's got a great newsletter. So if you are, have a look at her website, kellyexeter.com.au, and she does have a terrific newsletter. So anywho, long and involved intro, in the post, I want you to see me there. How was that for a segue, Dean? Really impressive. How I Fund My Creative Life is all about the reality of what happens if you don't write a 600-word article that then goes viral and results in an international publishing deal. And it talks about the fact that, there are people who make a living wage from their art and they get to pursue it full time, and then there are those who don't. And most creative people fall squarely into category two. And I include myself in that because, my living wage, so to speak, is made up of a whole range of different income streams. And I think it's really important that people don't necessarily get lost in what they necessarily see on social media of what, some creative people are doing, and think that you have to, throw yourself bodily into your art. And a lot of people who try that don't eat very well.
Yes.
And I personally like my food, and my children are, really like their food right now. So, it comes down to it that most creative people have day jobs. They have some other job that pays their bill, pays their bills, and hopes, and then they have to find a way to make space within all of that other stuff that's going on to also, fulfill that creative part of themselves. And so Kelly talks about, the different ways that she funds her creative life. So she writes books for other people. She edits other people's books. She coaches nonfiction authors. She speaks at events. Most of her work actually comes from she runs a terrifically successful website design business. called Swish Design in Western Australia, most of her, like, that is the bulk of her income. So I think it's if you looked at what Kelly looks like online, you know, she has a lot of books, she does a lot of stuff. But the reality is that grinding the gears for all of that stuff is the work that she does in her design company, her day job. And I think, you know, there's this notion that unless you're sitting in a garret starving and giving all to your art, that it's not, you're not a success, a creatively successful person, which I think is a dangerous thing, because if you really want to make a success of your creativity, you actually have to feed it in other ways, and that's, you know, bodily as well as mentally. You know, it's a lot of the stuff that you do in a day job can be an incredibly fulfilling part of feeding into your creativity as well. Getting out talking to people, really helpful for creativity. I find personally, I mean, my preference would be to sit at home all day and just, you know, write books. But the reality of that is, if I ever try to do that, I just find myself blocked. I really find myself, I sit there and I'll write my 1,000 words a day that I would write anyway if I was working my day job. And then I don't really ever get much beyond that. And that may well be because it's a habit, and that's the way, you know, I've always managed myself. But it's a pretty good habit because it allows me to do lots of different things. And I think that managing to do that is probably the way forward for most people, because you get that fulfillment of your creativity, but you're also funding an actual life, which I think is probably a bonus, don't you think, Val?
Yeah, definitely. And I would say, because one of the things that Kelly gives an example of is Elizabeth Gilbert, who obviously wrote Eat, Pray, Love and Big Magic. Kelly says, funded her early years of writing by working at a bar. And obviously working at a bar is very different to writing. But yes. For example, she also gives the example of Caroline Overington, who published 12 books and still works as the associate editor of The Australian. Now, who's to say, though, that Caroline doesn't think of her work as The Australian as just as creative as her books? I mean, maybe she doesn't. I don't know. I mean, we have interviewed Caroline before on this podcast, but we didn't ask that specific question. For some people, that other stuff, especially if it's writing related, or whatever creative outlet related, they might actually think that that is just as creative and just as important a part of creativity as the actual producing of a novel or of art or of whatever.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I guess it depends on your definition of creativity. If you feel that what you're doing is your creative process, you know, some people think that creating a business is their creative output, then hey, that's okay. I guess it just depends on what your definition is. But it's a good post, and Kelly's the real deal. So we will put that link in the show notes. Now, let's move on to our competition this week.
What is it?
We have 4 copies of the novel The Perfect Couple by Aussie author Lexi Lanthman, who will be interviewing in the coming weeks, to give away. The entries close on the 23rd of October. So a little bit about the book. Sarah and Marco Moretti are the perfect couple. Together they have travelled the globe building high-profile careers as archaeologists. Now at a dig in Florence, they are on the brink of the discovery of a lifetime. However, their marriage is not what it seems. Da, da, da.
We need to get some sound effects, don't we?
Yes. I quite like doing them, actually.
I know you do. I know.
So if you want to enter, then go to writercentre.com.au/win. That's writercentre.com.au/win. And if you're listening to this podcast in the future, don't worry, just still go to that link, because you will find some other awesome competition for you to enter. So that is The Perfect Couple by Lexi Lanthman. All right. Now, Al?
I'm bracing myself. I am. I'm braced.
Are you ready for the word of the week?
Oh, Val, I'm so ready. So ready.
Okay. So this is so cool. It's cat optometry. Oh, I can't even say it. Cat optometry. Cat optometry. So spelt cat, C-A-T, and then O-P-T-R-O-M-A-N-C-Y. Cat optometry. Oh, that's really hard. Cat optometry. Whew.
Are you going to ask me what I think if I know what it means?
Do you?
I'm just sitting here like trying to work out if you finished having a go at pronouncing it yet.
I'm usually good at pronouncing. This is really bad. Anyway, because I heard going.
Do you practice before we do this or is it just
I should.
Are you just like sight reading? Well, I would – I mean, you know, I don't know. Are you going to illustrate this one with a picture of one of your gorgeous cats? Is it a cat?
Highly likely. Well – I was attracted to this word. Isn't it funny how you can be attracted to a word? But anyway, I was attracted to this word because it had the word cat in it, but it's got nothing to do with cats.
Oh, well, that was disappointing for you then, wasn't it?
I know. It actually means divination by means of reflections in mirrors and looking glasses and so on. So in other words, it's using a mirror or something reflective to tell the future. Because you know like how you have tarot cards and – Yeah. You know how you have like tarot cards and stuff like that to, you know, tell the future? Well, this is similar, but you don't use tarot cards. You use mirrors.
Okay.
It's like.
I don't quite know what to say to that. I don't have a response at this point. So I've never heard of that.
Yeah, because you know how like the evil witch, she goes, mirror, mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest?
Oh, now it makes sense. I'm so glad we have fairy tales. Yeah, I wouldn't have known. Yeah. Mirror, mirror on the wall. So that's what she's doing.
Yeah, I think like it's a version of it. Yeah, because people in the medieval times and stuff like that used to, you know, yeah, the soothsayers and the those sorts of people, they used to use mirrors as a way to tell the future.
There you go.
There you go.
The things you know, Valerie.
The things you know, the things you learn. So cat optometry, use it this week. Give it a go, listeners.
Yeah, good luck with that. That's all I
yeah,
can
good
say.
Luck.
Good luck with that one.
It's kind of like I feel that I practice cat optometry every day when I look in the mirror and I see my future. Just go, oh, my God, you need more sleep. If you don't get more sleep, this is going to happen. If you don't do more exercise, this is going to happen. If you don't put on some concealer today, the kids across the road are going to get scared. You know, I reckon I do cat optometry every day.
Again, I have no response to that. I'm just going to leave that one right there.
All right. Instead then, let's move on to our writer in residence this week.
I don't know if I can. I'm just slightly traumatized by the concept. Okay, no, let's. What a good idea. Let's move on.
Okay, well, our writer in residence this week is the writer, memoirist, and actor Steve Bisley. Now, so many listeners are going to be familiar with Steve Bisley. He's been certainly on our screens for many, many years, starting off in Mad Max, the original Mad Max. He's been in countless television series and movies ever since. For many years, he played Detective Jack Christie on Water Rats. And a few years ago, he released his first memoir called Still Ways. And this is also a memoir. It's called All the Burning Bridges. It's such a good read. I know that it's going to be definitely a very popular Christmas present, regardless of whether you're a guy or a girl, even though the cover looks like it should, you know, be a present for a guy because it's Steve Bisley in some kind of full Mad Max getup. But it's a beautiful – it's beautifully written. It really is. And I had the pleasure of having a chat to Steve. So let's have a listen to that interview. So, Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure.
Now, do you realise, Steve, that you were almost responsible for me missing my plane last week?
Why?
Because I was so engrossed in this book, All the Burning Bridges by Steve Bisley, and my plane was at 5:30, and I was sitting in the lounge and I was reading it, and it's a page turner. I've read it from cover to cover in practically one sitting, with the exception on getting on a couple of pieces of transport. And at 5:27, I looked up and went, "Oh my God, my plane leaves in 3 minutes!" And I had to run like the wind in order to get there. Fortunately, I was the last passenger on, and I made it. And everyone gave me dirty looks.
I'm so glad.
But I didn't announce to the plane it was because of you.
Oh, good on you. Well, I'm glad you were so transported that you nearly missed your plane, but equally I'm glad you made the flight.
Yes, transported from the first page, because it sure starts off with a bang.
It sort of does, doesn't
Literally.
It?
Literally.
Yeah, it's a little bit like, to me, the prologue's a little bit like Raymond Chandler. It's sort of Raymond Chandler-esque. In fact, I've flirted with the idea of writing each chapter in the style of different writers that I like, but finally I got back to just me. But, it does. It does grab you. I think
it does. Now, tell us, just for some of the listeners who haven't got a hold of the book yet, tell us what it's about. And obviously, it's a memoir, but just describe, you know, what period of your life it's about, or what aspects of your life you decided to write about.
Okay. Well, the first book was Stillways, which was a childhood memoir. So I'd then been contracted to, which I'm writing at the moment, a novel, my first novel for HarperCollins. But between Stillways and the novel, I talked to another publishing house and they thought I had another memoir in me. And so All the Burning Bridges is a sort of adult memoir, where Stillways was a childhood one. So when I started it, I thought I would just progress on from when Stillways left off. Mm. Stillways finishes when I'm around 17, when I left school, and I go to the city. And I thought, okay, it started there, but then it took a different turn in the opening, which you mentioned. And I don't quite know where that came from, but I enjoyed it myself. So we have a little prologue, and then it sort of butts up to where Stillways left off. But then it sort of goes boom, and it goes everywhere. And it's, to me, and I said in another interview that what I tried to do with this book was to not be as bridled as I was with Stillways. I wanted to just transport me where it wanted to go. And that's what it is, really. And to me, that's memory. To me, that's memory. Mm. Memory is fleeting. Memory is captivating. Memory comes and goes. Memory is, the tenses change. Mm. Sometimes you're in the moment. Sometimes you're reflecting on past events. And hopefully that's the nature of All the Burning Bridges.
That's interesting how you say sometimes you're in the moment and sometimes you're reflecting on past events, because I felt that in some chapters it was like you've got these great stories that you're telling your friend, over a beer, and in some chapters it was very much reflection. It was very much, it was very much being in the moment, sorry, is what I meant. And it was like it was in your head.
Yes.
But it's interesting that you say kind of went everywhere, which it sort of did. There's stories from different aspects of your life, but it does hang together. So what did you do, which is very important and very powerful, what did you do then to make it hang together? Did you write a bunch of things and then take out stuff? Did you think of a jigsaw? How did it work?
Okay, well, in comparison to the first book has a sort of a linear progression through it, through the various ages, and it has a developing line through the book that you can follow. You know, I'm age 8, then I'm, you know, 9, 10, 12 through to 17. But this one, when I say unbridled, I was guided by where whatever memory landed on me at the time. So there is a progression, but it's out of – I didn't ever sit and plot the whole book thinking, oh, I'll write about the, you know, truck driving here or when I went to drama school there. Each one came to me with a sort of instruction to write this now. You know, there was – yeah, I know. It's sort of – so there was never – there was never a shuffling of the deck when I'd finished. The book sort of came to me as we read it today.
That's incredible because it really does have a strong thread. So I thought, that, well, that there must have been some other technique, but that's pretty incredible. So during – many people are very familiar with you as an actor. During your acting career, at some point did you think, I'm going to do writing on the side? Or, you know, how come about?
No. So I'd had the idea to write about the farm with the first book. It's called Stillways, which is the name of the farm where I grew up.
Yep.
And I had the title first. It was always going to be called Stillways, but I had no real end point. And I thought, I don't know whether I can write. And I'd, you know, I've spent a lifetime really blowing life into other people's words. That's what I do as an actor. I thought, I've got a story to tell. I'm sure I've got a story to tell. And I knew nothing about the process. I mean, obviously I'd play with words. That's what I do for a living, but not my own words. And then one day I thought, oh, damn it, I'll start. And and I started and I'd written 10 pages and I was having dinner with an author, a friend of mine, and I had this sort of – I was writing longhand and I had, you know, the notepad in my backpack at the dinner, and my friend said, oh, so what have you been doing? What work are you up to and blah? And I said, I've started to write a book. I said, it's a memoir about where I grew up and blah. And so she insisted on reading it, and so I let her, and she said, oh, you've got to send this to my publisher. And I said, no, I just want to write the book. You know, she said, oh, no, that's not the way it works and blah. So she was my first sort of – she was my first guide into the mosaic world of publishing. So she insisted and then sent it to her publishers, and then there was some interest, and then they made me an offer to write the book. So welcome to publishing.
Yes, and it did very well. It got listed in awards. Did that really then give you the taste of, did you decide then I'm going to take this seriously, I'm going to do this?
Well, I suppose I was about 50 pages into Stillways, the first book, and they had made me an offer on the book. And I thought, well, somebody else, not only my friend who I first showed it to, but other people think I can write. But by page 50, I started to realize what people talk about in this world of publishing, about the voice in the book. And there was a voice in the book, and I identified the voice and I liked it. I really liked it. And some days were pure joy. And other days were just hard and hard and nothing's changed. You know, I'm writing the novel now and it's like, you know, I've been battling away today. But writing the first book was a little like playing your first game of golf to me. You know, you go out, you know nothing about it, you swing and things happen and you have a good time. And you go back for the second game of golf and you think, I've got to hit, you know, I've got to be careful, and then I look at the ball and then, oh, gee, and then it goes, you know, to shit. So that's pretty much how it's been developing. But look, the good days and great days. And I,
yes,
and I love the process. And if I could make a living out of this other career that I've found, then that's all I do.
Yeah.
Because I'm in love with it. I just love it so much.
What do you love about it? What aspect of it is so fabulous for you?
I think after, you know, some days when you fit, you know, a seam of gold, when it all sort of works and people talk about the muse arriving and all of that stuff and, you know, we forever chase the muse. But, you know, there's wonderful days when it all feels like it's worked. And I think, and it has worked, you know, it has worked. And I've had days, of, like I was saying before, of absolute joy, and that's what I continue to chase, because if it's informing me and I'm my worst and best critic, and I'd probably over-edit to buggery, but I know if it's working or not, and when it works, it's fantastic.
So tell me about the process, particularly with this book, the one that's out now. When you said that you let the memories come, in a sense, did you give yourself a period of time to finish the manuscript? And if so, did you have like a target for each day or week? How did you make sure it all came out?
Yeah, okay. Well, I have two careers. I'm an actor as well. So, and what I can't do is I can't perform and write at the same time. I have to do one or the other. So, and I've been involved in the last 2 years with a television series. It takes up around 3-4 months of the year to do. So while that's happening, I can't write. So, and I don't want to start anything and then have to go back to it. So I've actually wrote all the Burning Bridges. I wrote Stillways, the first book, in 6 months, which people tell me is fast.
Yes.
And I think for memoir, maybe it's easier, you know, because you do have the raw materials. But so I wrote all the Burning Bridges, really. I'd started, then I got this work, and so I had to leave it. And so I left it and came back to it. So in actual writing time, all the Burning Bridges was probably a year in the making, a year in writing. But I try and get, so I sit down, I've got a strict schedule. I sit down at 9 o'clock in the morning and I get up at 5 o'clock. It's like a job to me. I have to be strict about that. And if I get 5 made pages done in a day, I'm happy.
Are you still writing longhand?
No. some days I do. Some days, because I'm so bad at typing, it comes too fast and I need to get it down. So I'll write longhand and then transpose it at the end of the day into a document.
Right.
But, yeah, if I do 5 made pages a day, I'm happy.
So it's that's very disciplined of you. Now, a lot of people who have some kind of profile who write books, particularly memoirs, and I've read many, they're a part of the thing that works for them. And part of the thing that some readers find interesting is their life experience, obviously, but the people who have come into their life. In other words, it's full of, there's a lot of name dropping. That's probably an unkind word, but there's a lot of, there are a lot of names of other famous people that they have met along the way. And that is a point of interest, but probably with the exception of Mel Gibson, because you both started at the same time. There's not a single name, I would say. Almost no names in this. In fact, you don't name the television shows that you're on and that sort of thing. So there's none of that relying on the glitz and glamour of celebrity. Was that
a conscious decision?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I wanted no names in it, including Mel's, but I realised that so many people would know when I mentioned the film that you know, I'd have to name him. It was sort of compulsory. Mm. But I avoided everybody else's.
Yes, because, you did.
And I wanted it to be completely that way all the way through the book. And I had to make that one concession. And I think I name Jasper, my youngest. I have six children. Jasper is 12.
Mm.
When we go to America, and Scarlett, my daughter, is 14, is dancing in LA, and Jasper and I go to Arizona. Mm. Then I name them. But pretty much there are no other names in the book. Also, I'd given each chapter a heading as well. They were all, you know, the chapters had a descriptive sort of one-liner heading. Mm. And then I removed those as well because I wanted it to be, you know, you mentioned page turn. I wanted people, as they turn the page from chapter to chapter, to be transported like in memory. That people, where does it go now? And that can be anywhere. So I didn't want to distill each chapter into a one line heading to give people any indication of where the book was going. I wanted it to be to unravel as they went.
Yes.
Yeah.
And with the, I think that it's not jarring at all, the fact that there are no names in there. It actually works. Mm. And I picked it up because I, you know, look at things analytically. And was it hard to write it that way?
No.
No?
No. You know, in a way, I hated taking some of the chapter heads out because there was one called In Arno Est, which means in the arse in Latin. And, and there was the milk bower, which is Dutch for milkman.
Yes. I meant the people's names.
Oh, sorry.
Was it hard to write it without the people's names? Because it is a normal thing to, you know, name people.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. You know, the cover is similarly, the cover has a picture of me from the character I played in Mad Max. Mm. And a journalist asked me the other day, he said, won't people think, you know, that maybe it's going to be a book about, you know, your life in your other career, in performance? And I said, it's the last thing I'd write. I can't bear those books. I cannot bear them. About when I did this and then who I work with. And like you were saying, the name-dropping books. Mm. So I dropped all the names in a way. I'm a name-dropper because I've dropped them all. There isn't you know what I mean? So it is name-dropping in the pure sense. It wasn't difficult to write. I know the people I'm talking about.
Yes.
But that was that was a decision I made very early in the piece. I thought I want it to be more the event than the names. You know, equally, there are no photos in any of my memoirs. He said, having written only two, but there are no photos. So because if I pick up a memoir and, you know, with a named person, and then I immediately, if it looks like there's photos, that's where I go to first. Let's have a look at the photos. And I didn't want that. I want it to be purely about the stories in the book, purely about the memory, and not a photographic reference to it.
When you say that the memories unfolded and you've captured them in that way, the thing is, after it was done, or, you know, your first draft was done, the thing is, you've lived quite an eventful life. Were there then stories that came up afterwards that you thought, oh, maybe I should put that in, or, you know what I mean?
Oh, I still do, you know, even after, like I have the book sitting beside me and every day I come and think, oh, well, you know, I could have written that in. But as I said, it led me, and I think that was a decision. I tried to free myself to the point where I'd be led by it rather than me leading the story, me leading the event. And one would naturally follow, you know, when I would complete what I thought was, you know, the end of that story, then I would you know, meditate on where it would go and something would occur to me. And it wasn't ever, I shall write about, you know, what, I didn't ever get up in the morning and go for the workout and come and put my bum in the writer's seat and then think, oh, where will I go today? Will I write about, you know, that, or will I write about that, or what was the choice? It came as, it came to me as the notion.
Okay. And so when you then submitted that to your publisher, was there, did that, did it, your first draft work for them, or was there much of a structural edit or stuff to be changed apart from obviously just little things?
Nothing changed.
This is extraordinary, Steve. This is extraordinary.
You know, I could
because it works so well. This is extraordinary.
We could do a whole rave about editors. Mm-hmm. You know, all my work, in my other job, I'm continually edited, you know, in performance and television and film. It's another thing I like about writing is in my other work, I'm edited all the time. There are so many hands on what I do.
Yeah.
That when I write, it's me, and I'm not an editor's friend, I have to tell you. I'm not. And there was some I was blessed in the first book that I had an editor at HarperCollins who completely got Stillways from the get-go, you know. Right. And she wrote me this wonderful email that said, look, she was so chuffed to be working on the book, but she also said, if you want it to go out exactly as you've written it, then that's the way it will be. I will offer some suggestions and then, you know, you can either take those on board or, you know, and pretty much there were some minor things, words, but I self-edit all the time. I probably do it too much, but because I crank backwards and forwards, and the thing about that I'm very conscious of in my work is the rhythm in the work.
Yes.
Yeah. The beats and rhythms. And I get it from my mother. In Stillways, there are about half a dozen of her poems in the back of the book, and she was such a great wordsmith. She spent a life, you know, constructing the best way to say something and to write equally, to write something. She was a poet, and you know, her treasury of words was just wonderful. And so I get it from her, and I'm very conscious of the beats and rhythms in the work myself. So if somebody else puts a hand on that, it jars me to the core. So I'm not an editor.
Tell me about your self-editing process then. Once you've do you do it straight away? Do you wait till you have a chunk of text? No,
I do one after my five made pages day.
Right.
When I transcribe it after I finish the day, I transcribe it into a Word document. And then I can work on it, and I start to work on the beats and rhythms in the work. And I'm very conscious of if something needs another word or if something needs that tailored, and then the true work starts for me, really.
Yeah.
Then. And so when I've – and maybe that makes me a bit more wary. I'm not more wary, but I know I've done a lot by the time it leaves my desk. Mm. And so I am very – but I am very – you know, I'm like a female crocodile in breeding time around the nest. I really am. And I find that you want to have a really good idea to be better than the one I've got. because, look, an editor is just another interpretation of your work, and I'm not prepared to loose the reins on that a lot. Yeah.
Well, if it works, and obviously it does. So now you're writing a novel. Mm. So very, very different. You've written two memoirs now. At what point did you think, oh, I'm going to turn my hand to fiction? And at any point during your acting career, did you think I'm going to write, you know, screenplays and go into that side of it, which was a bit more related?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because because I've had over 30 years of working on other people's stories, you know, I'm really aware of, you know, how the story unfolds, and I'm forever thinking, oh, it'd be better if that was, you know, in the theatre you get the wonderful luxury of that rehearsal period in the room with the other company of actors, and that's what you're doing all day. You're massaging these words, you're finding a way to breathe life into these characters to get them off the page and up and walking and talking. And that's all you've got is the word on the page, you know. But I've always had a tremendous respect for writers, you know. When I work, you know, in film, television and theatre, I'm always very, very conscious that somebody sat, like I'm sitting at the moment, just them and the tyranny of the blinking cursor or the blank page and wrote this stuff. So that's a tremendous responsibility to the writer. But after Stillways, I thought, and I think my publisher at HarperCollins said, we think maybe you're a memory, maybe you're masquerading as a memorist, maybe you're a fiction writer. And I thought I was too, and I wanted a crack at it. I really did want to write it. And I liked this book that I've started. I'm really, you know, my partner lives in Perth, and we were talking last night over FaceTime, and she said she knows I've just started. And we're going away on holiday soon. She said, I know what it's going to be like. You're going to say, I need a couple of hours today, you know, because I'm at that stage. It's like being, you know, in an old house that has lots of rooms, and all the doors are locked, and you've got a large ring with all those old skeleton keys dangling off it, and you're trying to get into the room. And, you know, right now that's where I am with a big bunch of keys. Trying to unlock each door. And when I get the door open, I can go in the room and play, but I'm still trying to find the door.
Right. And so you're finding it quite a different experience to memoir?
No, I've found that with the memoirs as well.
Right.
The bunch of keys. Mm-hmm. But once I'm in the room, I can play, and then I can really play. You know, I once, I think it was after Stillways came out, and I did an interview with someone. I said, well, I can't wait to, you know, to start the novel because I won't be bridled by the truth. I think it'll be easier. Well, I was kidding myself. It's all self-deception.
What are you finding most challenging about writing fiction?
I write quite, and you probably get it, I write, there's a certain sense of sort of, it's quite sparse, my writing. I don't, I avoid conversation. I avoid writing conversation, and I'm writing conversation now. But it's completely different. It's a completely different structure, this novel, and that's the nature of the difference between the two mediums, I think. But I'm finding it delicious, and I love authors who write conversation well and detail. I'm in love with the detail in Hannah Kent's work. I just love Hannah Kent's work. And
Go on. No, go on.
Okay, you go.
Well, when's the novel coming out? We have to know.
That's the piece of string. How long? I'd be hoping, and I think my publisher's probably in the same page. Get it? That's the writing. I'd like for next year, late next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to be able to have the time to not do anything else but that. But that's probably folly. Yeah.
Yes. So just backing up to my other question of being in that writing world, were you tempted to write scripts?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Stillways is actually, I'm co-writing a film draft, well, we're up to about draft five.
Mm-hmm.
I'm co-writing it with a writer who's in London. The screenplay of Stillways, the first book, the first memoir, because It was her suggestion. She read the memoir, and then she rang me from London and said, "Oh, this has got to be a film, surely." And I thought, "Oh, a film? Oh, it's a wonderful period, you know. It's the 50s and 60s in that sort of little rural scape." And I think there's as the world gets crazier and madder, and that there's a certainly Hollywood seems to be on the nostalgia bandwagon a bit. Mm. You find this sort of, you know, people looking for some solace in the past and in nostalgia and those and the wonderful look of that time. So we're seeing where that will develop. I'd love to write for film. I really would. Mm-hmm. And hopefully this novel, hopefully you can point a camera at this novel, I think.
Right. Mm. But these are – what you're referring to are adaptations of books that you have written. Did you ever think of writing, you know, a script for the cop show that you're on or that sort of thing?
No, I didn't. Not at the time, but my thinking has changed. But I was so, you know, to me, performance was everything, and that's where all my energies went. But now I'm a more mature actor. I would like, now that I've sort of got the writing bug, I'd love to write for the screen. Mm. I'd like to write for the theatre too. But I think I'm more drawn towards writing for the screen. It just offers a bigger canvas to play on, really.
With this book, All the Burning Bridges, were there any parts of your life that were hard to write about, or conversely, were there parts that you just loved writing about?
I write on depression because I went through a bout of depression, which was really the springboard into me starting to write in a way, because, you know, I was saying I had the idea of Stillways, which I'd had for a couple of years, and I was hit by this debilitating bout of depression that I had no idea where it had come from. I have more of an idea now that I've been through it, but it's just impossible to explain to anyone who hasn't had it what it's like. And I was forced to pull out of lots of shows that I've been asked to do, and I kept trying to perform. So I'd say yes, and then I wouldn't be well enough to do it, so I'd pull out of another show. Mm-hmm. And I pulled out of probably half a dozen, theatre, film, television, the whole deal. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't do it. There was, you know, it just that awful condition just really destroys your sense of self, your sense of, you know, anything with any spontaneity just gets rubbed out, you know. Mm. None of the medications that they suggested worked for me. Mm. So it was just a matter of hoping it would one day go away. Mm. And it probably, if I look at the whole time frame, it's probably 10 years out of my life that I was really, really unwell. So I'm writing, and I do write about it in the book.
Yes.
And the girl, because I live in Vaucluse, quite close to the cliffs.
Yes.
The legendary cliffs.
Yes.
And I write about it, and I touch on it because, and like I said, I was guided to write by whatever came to me, and that came to me one morning. I was sitting here, as I say in that chapter, I'd sat down, I got a coffee, I'd gone out early to, you know, like at 5 a.m. and got a coffee and come back here, and it was a wintry day and the rain was lashing around, and I started to write on that condition. Mm. Yeah.
Well, yeah, very powerful.
But there was some, and that was, I'm well now, so it was okay. But
yes.
But the joyous stuff was great, and it was terrific. But was one of my eldest, you know, I had four older children, two young ones. One of my eldest boys said, "But do you think it's wise to write about growing dope under your house in the Blue Mountains? And I said, yes. What? Couldn't they might fire you off your current work. You know, so they, he said, I'm just, you know, it happened.
Yes, it sounded like such a hedonistic period of your life, all the things that happened in the Blue Mountains house, but it sounded like a lot of fun.
it was fun, but it was also a great place for, you know, the kids would all come and friends would come, and I do write about some of the high times, excuse the pun, but it was a wonderful place where that affected everyone who came there in a really positive way. Mm. And it was a lovely sort of, it was peaceful, it was just beautiful. One of those real welcoming houses that you walk into and you feel the life that's been before you in there.
Mm. It had that. Mm.
And where I live now has that as well. So, yeah.
Tell me now, you are actually talking to me in your writing space. Can you describe what your writing space comprises of and what you look at and what is in there, just to give us a picture?
Okay. So I write in one of the back rooms. I live on the top floor of an apartment block in Vaucluse. And if I look out of the door I'm looking at now, so right in front of me is my big computer. I write on an iMac. So there's a window right in front of me which has a green belt outside of trees and plants. And then to my if I look to the right, there's the ocean. And I write in summer, the door is always open because the beautiful nor'easter blows straight off the ocean. So it's pure ozone. Mm. It's wonderful. It's fairly tidy at the moment. It's not always that way. There's a printer to the left of my computer. There's notepads everywhere, which I'm about to box up because I've got about 8 boxes of notes written in longhand for the first book and probably double that for this book.
Wow.
When I write longhand, there's stacks of them. Mm-hmm. And I really like stationery.
So, yes.
Yeah, I'm stationary. So I buy really nice notes, and they're of all different sorts, just the one that, you know, appealed to me at the time.
Yes.
Then they're all there, stacks of that, and then there's media things, pages of media things I've got to do in the lead up to the launch of this book. And then there's a bicycle pump, pictures of my children, a box with various leads that go on various things. There's several rocks on my desk that I've collected from around different places around Australia.
Rocks?
Yeah, little rocks.
Okay.
Stones. There's a cup that says Australia's Greatest Dad from Jasper. He gave it to me on Father's Day. Mm-hmm. There's a bound, beautiful leather-bound notebook that Rebecca, my partner, gave me. That's special, I only write special things. There's a white box that my daughter gave me on Father's Day, which has pictures of her and I when she was a baby, and now she's 14, and there's a poem in there, and it's all surrounded with pink paper. There's my Zoom microphone.
Mm-hmm.
That I record stuff when the mood takes me. And look, it's pretty clean, but it's going to be cleaner because I need to clear the decks before I get serious, before the first door really opens.
Yes, from that skeleton key. Well, I have no doubt that many, many other books, whether they're novels or maybe there's another memoir in
there's no Steve. More memoirs, Valerie. There are no more memoirs. I promise you, there is no more memoirs. That's
all
it.
All right. Well, we certainly look forward to the next one, the novel then. Thank you so much for your time today, Steve. Fantastic book. Everyone should go buy it. It's awesome.
Thanks, Valerie. Thank you so much.
This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. Our course, Inside Publishing, gives you a peek inside the complex world of publishing. created by author of more than 30 books, Pamela Freeman, who also writes as Pamela Hart. The course gives you a step-by-step guide on everything you need to know about the publishing process and how this should affect your writing, pitching, and submissions. It's essential information if you want to navigate the publishing world and get the best chance for your book's success. You'll learn about the copyright issues that will affect you, what territories you need to negotiate for, and how ebooks and audiobooks will impact your income. You'll also discover whether indie publishing or traditional publishing is better for your goals. With our online self-paced courses, you can learn in your own time with 12 months access to all course materials. Find out more at writerscentre.com.au/publishing. That's writerscentre.com.au/publishing. There you go, Steve Bisley.
So I have to ask you, Valerie, was there a little bit of a fangirl moment there for you? Because I know that you are quite the Water Rats aficionado, if there is such a thing.
I am actually an aficionado, and I did not mention that to Steve in the interview, nor in the pre-chat or post-chat, because I didn't want to come across, you know, unprofessional.
Embarrassing.
Embarrassing. But I have to say, because I was actually overseas for the years that Water Rats was on TV, but I got it through the local cable channel, and my flatmate at the time was also from Sydney. And so we were both living in Singapore at the time, and I was working for ACP. So I missed, you know, Water Rats in Australia. But I got it the entire time I was overseas through this cable channel, and it was literally this nightly ritual my flatmate and I had, because we missed Sydney so much. We both really did. And he would make dinner and we would sit in front of the TV and watch an episode of Water Rats and just wish we were there.
Oh, that's hilarious. And was it the water you were missing, the blue sky, the Australian accent?
Everything. So, and because it was set in Sydney and it was all set on the harbour, it was just so, it was probably a little bit torturous for us in the sense that
really,
we weren't there, but it was our connection to home. And that was, and therefore I watched every single episode of Water Rats. And I was actually, it was also coincided with a time that I was thinking, oh, I wonder what it's like to be a script writer. And at the time I was working at ACP, now Bauer, you know, in glossy magazines, and I did nighttime courses in script writing. So I did script writing. I bought all the books. I talked to a lot of script writers. And one of the things, and I was quite interested in it, you know, and I thought, I'll pursue this. And I thought, hey, why not intern as a scriptwriter, you know, just to get the experience. Even though I was already in a career, I still am a big believer in on-the-job experience. So I thought, okay, well, where could I intern, you know, as a scriptwriter? And I thought, well, what's my favourite TV show right now? It's Water Rats. So I contacted them and I interned actually at Water Rats. So I flew back to Sydney for a period, interned, you know, even though I was already 30 or whatever, in the script department at Water Rats. I had to take the ferry out to Goat Island every day.
Wow.
And it was really interesting just to see how they all collaborated, and, you know, because it's so different to writing a magazine article or even working in a magazine office, which you and I are both very familiar with. Working in a script department is so collaborative and there's so many hands involved. And actually, just a bit of trivia, because there was a script consultant on, I don't even know whether Steve knows this, I should have asked him. There was a script consultant who was a police person, police officer, whatever the right word is. But his job, he was seconded to Water Rats to make sure that, you know, police procedures were correct and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And Steve Bisley's character name is Detective Jack Christie, and that actually came from that script consultant because his 3-year-old nephew is Jack Christie. And he said that the first time the little 3-year-old saw, you know, Steve Bisley on TV and whatever scene it was and the words Jack Christie were mentioned, the kid screamed and burst into tears.
Oh.
The 3-year-old.
The trauma.
The trauma, I know. But anyway, yes, yeah, so in answer to your question, I was a bit of a Water Rats fan. It kept me sane while I was overseas. But unrelated to that, I do think that this memoir, Steve's latest memoir, is an excellent book and I highly recommend. All right.
Lovely.
There we go.
I can't believe we didn't mention any of that to him. You were very restrained.
Oh, so hard. It's like when I interviewed, you know, John Bon Jovi.
Let's not relive that as well.
All I could do to, you know, stay professional. Because I am professional. Anyway.
Yes. Today's episode is brought to you by Wandering Halves.
Oh, didn't you watch Water Rats?
Oh, you know, maybe
ago.
Not really. A bit, maybe.
Okay.
No, I was certainly not an avid watcher as you were.
Well, that's because you weren't, you know, overseas missing home, I suppose.
No, that's right, I wasn't. I was probably just going, oh, another TV show.
Yes, probably. All right. So we're almost at the end of this week's episode. What have you got in the coming week, Al?
Wow, just probably a whole bunch of fair to middling stuff. What I am doing, actually, no, I do have, there are some highs coming, let me tell you.
Tell me.
I'm going to be stepping out of my, you know, contentment zone here in my garden. And, well, I'm off to Singapore in a few weeks' time and I'm going to be presenting at the Singapore Writers Festival. I've got a couple of sessions. I know. So that's, that you're going to ask me about that and I'm going to be like, Val? I'm fantastic. So that's coming up, which is very exciting. So I'm sort of like, because I haven't really been overseas, I haven't been overseas for quite some time. My passport is gathering dust. So
is it valid?
I'm sort of
is
having
it
to,
valid? Have you checked
I
the
had
date?
To re- I've renewed it. It's all good. Okay. I'm ready to go. No, I had to renew it because I haven't been anywhere very interesting for a long time. So I'm having to remember things like travel adapters and, you know, stuff that you need to go overseas. Yes. So I'm making lists.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the good thing about Singapore, it's got the same electrical voltage thing.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so you
there's
just...
no
you do
travel
need the,
adapter for me.
No, you need you need the adapter, but you don't need, you know how in America it's 110 instead of 220?
Yeah. Cool.
So,
I'm so lucky I have you, Val. Otherwise I would be... very unsure. And listeners will be thrilled to know that Val has promised to send me her packing list for such engagements.
Yes. I used an app called Trip List. So, every single time I leave the house, well, not leave the house, but, you know, go on a plane, I use Trip List. And, so I'm going on a plane this week. I will be not going to Singapore. I will be going to Brisbane where I'm doing a bunch of things, but one of the things I am doing is a meetup with our Brisbane or Queensland members of the Freelance Writing Masterclass program. So that's going to be awesome. I'm really looking forward to catching up with you guys. I'm also, because you know how, like, I'm meant to be taking myself out on a creative date every week. Well, lately it hasn't been every week, but this week I'm taking myself out to Kinky Boots in Brisbane. So that's my little treat for myself. So hopefully
fantastic.
It's good.
We've been a little bit too busy painting to go on creative dates of late, haven't you?
Yes, but I need to bring them back, creative dates.
Bring back the creative date.
I reckon. All right. So where do we find you online, Al?
You'll find me at alisontait.com, alisontait.com. You'll find me on Twitter at Al Tait, altait. And you'll find me on Facebook and Instagram at Alison Tait Writer. And you, Val?
You'll find me at Valerie Koo, that's K-H-O-O, on Twitter and Instagram. And, connect with me on Facebook. But also make sure you join the podcast community on Facebook. Just search for So You Want to Be a Writer podcast community and request to join. We'd love to have you in there and connect with you there. Thanks so much for listening, everyone, and we look forward to chatting to you again next time.
Bye.
This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writer Centre, and there are lots of incredibly wonderful people behind the scenes who help make this podcast happen, apart from my lovely co-host, Alison Tate. There's also Ra and Stevie and Sarah and Dean and Kira and Farah and Nelly and Elmer and Alvin, and it's just a cast of thousands that actually work to bring this to you each week. So here's my little Easter egg for the week. What I'm watching. I am watching Hard Quiz with Tom Gleason. I just think that this is a hilarious show. It's this bizarre, strange quiz show on the ABC, if you haven't caught it. And there's usually four contestants, and they each have they select their own area of specialization. Like one guy might be an ABBA expert, or someone might be an expert in poisonous insects on the east coast of Australia, or someone will be an expert in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And it's interesting because these so-called experts are often the ones who don't get their own topic questions from their own topic right. But it's a great show, and it has me in stitches every single time. The other thing I'm doing as part of my little Easter egg is I am looking forward to, even though I'm watching Hard Quiz, I'm looking forward to watching The Mindhunter, which was just released on Netflix, starring Jonathan Groff. It is about somebody on the hunt of a serial killer, I think. But the reason I'm watching it is because, for those Hamilton fans out there, Jonathan Groff played King George and did a brilliant job of it. I'm just keen to see him play an FBI agent in this series. I'm looking forward to, as I mentioned in this podcast, meeting up with members of the Freelance Writing Masterclass program in Brisbane this coming week. So, looking forward to catching up with you and seeing how you're kicking your goals. And we're going to go through some feedback on some of your articles as well. What I'm reading is really a bit bizarre. I usually buy a book before I get on a plane. And so the last week when I was getting on a plane, I went to buy The Riviera Set by Mary S. Lovell, because I'm watching, unrelated to this, I'm watching Riviera on SBS. And it's just one of those places, you know, that's so evocative. It's like New York. Just the words New York make you kind of a bit happy. Well, the Riviera is so beautiful and glamorous. I thought, okay, I'm going to read The Riviera Set by Mary S. Lovell. But it was on the top shelf at the bookstore. And I'm not tall, vertically challenged. And so I couldn't reach. And there wasn't a ladder nearby. There wasn't a step ladder nearby. So I had to buy something on the fourth shelf instead of the top shelf. So I bought this book. It was because I was in a hurry, called The Four, as in the number four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google by Scott Galloway. It's so different from The Riviera Set. But it was the book I could reach. Anyway, I am flipping through interiors magazines like Inside Out and Belle, because this is my new thing, you know, interiors porn. I go in and out of phases of loving interiors porn, but at the moment I'm in one of those phases. And I'm interviewing this afternoon, actually, not for this podcast, because she's a photographer, but she's released a book called Upside Down Dogs. And all she's done is she's photographed dogs that are upside down. I think this is so cool. I'm interviewing her for my other podcast, So You Want to Be a Photographer, Obviously, it's not appropriate or relevant for this podcast because she's a photographer and it's really just lots of pictures. But, yeah, if you're interested in Upside Down Dogs, have a listen to that episode when it comes out. But it's such a cool book, Upside Down Dogs. Who would think one day, I'm going to take a whole heap of photos of dogs that are upside down and publish them in a book? Well, she did, and I have no doubt it's going to be very successful because it's one of those ideal gift books for Christmas. Anyway, that's my Easter egg for this week. I hope you have a great week.